is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films throughout the month of February with a collection of films by African directors from over 16 nations.
Films will be screened at Cascade PCC, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, showing Africa through African lenses, happening February 3rd until Saturday, March 4th, in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
Here at KBOO, on February 20th, we'll be celebrating National Love Your Pet Day. If you ever experienced the loss of an animal friend, you are welcome to share with us how you felt and how it changed you to lose that beloved friend and ally. An unfortunate downside to the blessing of the friendship our animal friends provide is the almost inevitable goodbye that comes when our dear friends' lifespans are far shorter than our own. You can send your audio to publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day. Or you can also call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voice mailbox 302 and go ahead and record your story. Email publicaffairs@kboo.org with any questions.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And today I'm Annie Warmke.
You are today. And we're going to talk about, I'm not quite sure what we're talking about, the difference between food forests and forest farming is what I've got written down here. Or my second title is small really beautiful? And that question is being posed to Catherine Favor. Now, Catherine is the Sustainable Agricultural Specialist based at the National Center for Appropriate Technologies out there in the Western Regional Office. And Catherine, according to the bio that I found about you on the internet, so it must be true, it says that you've worked on organic farms in California, Montana, and South America for over 10 years. You're a manager of an organic vineyard for several years, and you also spent 2 years in Paraguay with the Peace Corps working on food security and agroforestry projects with small farmers, and then 2 years in Argentina researching vineyard agroforestry systems. So, Catherine, is all of that true?
That is true. It's been 12 years now. That bio's a little old. But yes, I've been, you know, into agroforestry, all sorts of regenerative farming systems, but really into agroforestry for a long time. And I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Jay gave the Google version. Do you have anything else you want to add before we jump into the discussion?
Well, so I'll just tell you a little bit about my role at NCAT. Like you said, I'm the Agroforestry and Sustainable Agriculture Specialist. We've got all sorts of different specialists. So, you know, each person has their own area of expertise, and my area of expertise is agroforestry. So I get to provide technical assistance and training and education to farmers and ranchers every day so that they can farm more regeneratively. And I truly have the best job in the world. I'm so lucky. I'm an agroforestry nerd, and I am so excited to talk about agroforestry today and food forestry and forest farming and what the difference is between all those things.
Right. So just before we go, I'd like to just understand a little bit about what got you interested in this, because it feels like when I look at your history that you've been a pioneer. I know this is an old system that our ancestors used, but it's not an old system with modern people. So what got you interested so early?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in the city. I did not come from a farming background, but I knew that I wanted to be a farmer since I was 5 years old. and, you know, I really, because I'm from the city, I am interested in ways of applying agriculture to urban areas. And like you said, food forestry is an ancient practice. It's been around for millennia. And in fact, there's evidence that the entire Amazon rainforest is really a food forest that was intentionally planted by indigenous peoples, you know, like since time immemorial. And so, but now this food forestry is being applied to urban spaces. And that is really interesting to me because, like I said, I'm from the city. And so it's an agricultural practice that can be applied right to my own backyard to bring the community together and to produce healthy food locally. So that's really important to me, just from my background as a city girl. Yeah.
Great. So the thing is, there are a lot of terms that people throw around when it comes to food forests. And I know we'll talk some of those today, but could you just tell us a little bit about what's the difference between food forests, food forest gardens, and food forest farming?
Yes. There are so many terms. It can get confusing, but the way I like to think about it is there's one umbrella term called agroforestry, and underneath that umbrella term, there are all these other terms. And basically, in temperate regions like the U.S., there are six different recognized practices, or basically ways of arranging your trees and crops and animals into a single system. And forest farming is one of them, and food forestry is another one of them. And there are also other practices like silvopasture and alley cropping and windbreaks. There are lots of these different terms, but basically, in a nutshell, both food forestry and forest farming are different agroforestry practices. And should I get into kind of the differences between those two systems?
That would be great.
Yeah. Okay. So forest farming, you know, all these terms, they can take a lot of different forms, but in a nutshell, forest farming is the practice of planting high value understory crops under an existing or planted stand of overstory trees. So this could be like a native forest with an understory crop of like ginseng or shiitake mushrooms, or you could have...
You're basically saying the word understory means that you're planting underneath each of the layers. Like, so if you've got a big pecan tree and then you've got maybe some kind of regular fruit tree, and then maybe a dwarf fruit tree, and you just keep coming down till you've used up all that real estate. That's what the understory is, right?
Yeah. So, that's a good point. I would say the overstory is the highest layer of foliage in a forest ecosystem, and then the understory is any lower layer of foliage in a forest ecosystem. So, you know, there's always an overstory. And there could be multiple layers of understory or just one layer of understory. So it really depends on your system. But there is always an overstory and an understory. So, in forest farming, there's typically, you've got your overstory. And then under that, there's typically only one or two layers of understory, because the overstory trees are typically spaced so close together that very little light comes through the canopy
right,
to reach that understory layer. So you can typically only have one or two understory layers in forest farming. Now, in food forestry, you can have up to seven layers. So, it's a little bit different. In food forestry, your overstory trees are typically spaced further out. Some of them are a little bit shorter. And so there is more light that can reach other layers like bushes and herbaceous crops and vines and roots and all these other types of crops. So that's a little bit of the difference. It's kind of hard to visualize, but that's how I like to think of it. Like a forest farming, you could think of an overstory of like native forest with, you know, one layer of ginseng or shiitake mushrooms underneath. And then food forestry could be like an overstory of really, really tall trees, an understory of medium-sized trees, and then bushes, and then herbaceous crops, and then ground cover, and then vines, and then roots, and they all kind of work together. So that's kind of the difference.
Could you say what herbaceous means? Herbaceous.
Herbaceous. So that would be, you know, any like annual crops, I would say. Just shorter crops like broccoli, lettuce, tomatoes, asparagus.
All the conventional stuff.
Yeah, or just, you know, like shorter crops. Yeah.
I think Annie's trying to dumb this down so even I can understand it.
So he hears this a lot, yeah, just by accident, not because he's terribly interested, but.
Well, yeah, there are so many terms and it can get confusing. And, you know, it really, we do overcomplicate it with all these different terms, I think. Really, it's just, it comes down to diversity, right? And yes, that's what you're going for in food forestry. In a food forest, you're going for lots and lots of diversity.
Yeah.
I was going to mention, because something you had said about the Amazon, I was reading a Louis L'Amour Western type novel, and he actually mentioned in that, saying that when the people arrived at the Americas, they thought they were viewing virgin forests, but that the forests had actually been managed by native people for thousands of years, you know. Yes. And I just thought that was an interesting comment in a Louis L'Amour book.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm glad that is being recognized, because that is the way it is. All of our forests across the world have been intentionally planted and stewarded and propagated, and it's just neat that that's finally being recognized. It should be talked about.
Yep, it's a great thing, and I think it offers a lot of hope for the future. Yeah. To know that. So let's keep going, because the next thing on the list is silvopasture, and I always feel like that's a buzzword. In my life, it feels like a buzzword. I know it's not, but it just feels like that. People will say, oh, are you silvopasture? I'm like, no, I don't always know exactly what that means. I'm just doing what makes sense, what nature tells me.
Yeah.
Listening to my land, listening to the plants there, and then that tells me what to do next. So
yeah, that's a great question. Silvopasture is another one of these terms that falls under that umbrella term of agroforestry. And silvopasture is really just integrating trees, pasture, and livestock into a single system in an intentional way. And so that could look like, it could look like planting trees into a pasture and then rotating cattle underneath. It could be rotating baby doll sheep under an orchard. It could be, you know, even just like there are pastured poultry silvopasture systems, which just means, you know, having chickens under an orchard system or under a thinned forest system. So there's so many different ways that silvopasture can look, but it focuses on having an animal component integrated with tree and pasture components.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a minute, because one of the things that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has traditionally frowned on is that type of integration of livestock with woodland. And even though all the animals that we tend to raise are woodland animals, and so the first time I learned about this, and I'd like you to give us some examples, but I read in The Guardian a few years ago about a couple of really big estates, gentried estates there, where they owned like 1,000 acres. They were gonna lose the farm, as they say, and they decided that they would practice silvoculture. At silvopasturing. And so what they did is they just put a fence all the way around this perimeter, and then they introduced different livestock like hogs and cattle and so forth. And what began to happen was new plants appeared that hadn't been seen in 150 years. New birds came that hadn't been seen in a couple of hundred years. And they brought themselves out of a bankruptcy state because of what they were able to produce naturally. And it just feels like that is a good marriage of livestock practices and raising food. But I don't know about doing that on a smaller piece of land. How do you see that working?
Yeah, you can do it on any size land. And, you know, you brought up a really good point, because you know, there's definitely a right way and a wrong way to do it. If you just like let a bunch of cattle into the forest, they can do some harm to the tree's root systems and into the trees themselves. So you definitely want to make sure that you're, you know, introducing the right amount of animals for your piece of land. You want to make sure that you're thinning some trees so that there's enough light to reach, you know, pasture below so that cattle can survive. And so they're getting the right amount of nutrition. You know, you want to make sure that you're rotating your animals well. So there are a lot of things to think about. And I think that, you know, the USDA frowns upon just like letting big cattle run wild in the forest. And, you know, there are reasons for that. But if you do it in an intentional way, you're right. It has so many benefits. And like you mentioned, you can produce more per acre with silvopasture systems. And with any agroforestry system, they're on average 1.4 times more productive than monoculture systems. So yeah, that's a really great moneymaker for farms. But definitely you can do silvopasture on a small scale. And like, okay, for example, I worked on a food forest and silvopasture system in San Diego, which, you know, urban area. This was a farm. It was 8 acres in the middle of a city. And we had about 4 acres that was dedicated to a chicken silvopasture system. And so we had, you know, an orchard of elderberry trees and pomegranate trees. And in between, we had chickens go through. And it was incredible. They were good at doing pest control. They were kind of like the tillage for us. So we didn't have to, you know, go through with the tractor. Like they would shallowly till up the ground just enough to like get rid of weeds. But, you know, they didn't do any like deep tillage, which is so, you know, bad for the soil. It was just amazing. And we were able to do that on a very small scale. So I'd say that, you know, any agroforestry practice you could apply on a large scale or a small scale, which is super cool.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump in here and remind everybody that you're listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God. So I interrupted Catherine Favor, and Catherine is a sustainable agriculture specialist with the National Center for Appropriate Technologies. And Catherine, before you get back into the weeds of this, I just wanted to find out what is exactly the National Center for Appropriate Technology, because I saw in your details at your website, it's sort of highlighted Small is Beautiful, the book that came out in 1973 by Schumacher, and I was just wondering, is that kind of the whole focus? You know, I mean, how did that all play out and what do you guys do?
Yeah, it is the focus. That is how we started. We were born out of the idea of, you know, this appropriate technology movement, which, like you said, focusing on small local solutions. And we do a few different things. We have an energy team at NCAT. And so we work on a lot of different energy initiatives, from solar to, you know, weatherizing houses. And then we have our sustainable agriculture team, and that's what I'm on. And we actually manage the ATRA program, which is also known as the National Sustainable Agriculture Information Service. And so we provide free technical assistance and training, and education and educational resources to anyone, any farmer or rancher. So my favorite thing that we have a free hotline, and anyone can just call us up with any question under the sun about production or farming or how to be more sustainable. And you can actually talk to a human and just, yeah, talk and get answers for any question you have. So, you know, we do a lot of great things. And yeah, like I said, we have 30 different specialists, all with a different area of expertise. And I'm the agroforestry girl. So, yeah, you know, I'm always happy to be of service. Anyone can call me up or email me and I'd be happy to chat. Yeah.
Well, that's great. And so what I would like to do is bring us back to the list.
Always the taskmaster. I'm just listening. I wanna just call up Catherine just to ask about the weather in California. That sounds like
it's great today. It's great today.
All right, we don't want to hear about
there's
that.
There's snow on the ground here.
No, we have sun and we forgot what it looked like, but it came out this morning. So, or as our grandchild used to say, it came in. The sun is in, she would say, which makes perfect sense. Anyway. So the next thing on the list of for food for agroforestry and food forests is alley cropping. And could you give us a little bit of definition of that and how it's utilized?
Yeah. So alley cropping, that would be the practice of planting understory crops between rows of overstory trees. So you could imagine having this could be any crops. I've seen alley cropping systems with rows of pecan trees with wheat grown in the middle, or you could do rows of veggies in the middle. It really could be anything. You do want to be intentional about what trees you're pairing with what crops, because definitely, you know, in any agroforestry system, your overstory and your understory are going to be competing for resources. In particular, they're mostly going to be competing for water, nutrients, and light. And so definitely when you're pairing an overstory tree component with an understory crop component, you're going to want to make sure that they're kind of complementary and that they're not going to be competing too much for water, nutrients, and light. So there's a lot that goes into that. But in a nutshell, that's what alley cropping is. Yeah.
Yeah, that, well, what we're doing at Blue Rock Station is for now called alley cropping, although the intention, starting with the new plants that will arrive, the new material that will arrive at the end of March, then we will begin to plant basically like it's a forest and just sort of willy-nilly things will go where they're going to go. And we're going to have a planting day and everything. So, but I had to laugh because somebody came and said, oh, you're alley cropping. And I'm like, no, we're not alley cropping. We're just getting started. So,
So many terms. And, you know, these systems evolve over time. Like,
yes,
you can
yes.
start out with an alley cropping system that turns into a silvopasture system or food forest or forest garden. You know, and it is kind of silly to create these boxes for all these ways of just planting. You're probably doing lots of different cool things with your land, and it is kind of silly to put it into boxes.
Well, you know, the brain does that when it's got that short-term memory and it sticks it in some place that so it can remember it because it pairs it up with something else. That's what I figure people are doing. So anyway, so then the last category that I have is windbreaks. If you could talk a little bit about that and some examples.
Yeah. So windbreaks are rows of trees that are typically planted on the edges of fields or in strategic locations within your field with the primary goal of slowing down wind and then reducing erosion from wind. They can also be used to attract pollinators or beneficial insects. So hedgerows are another term that kind of go along with windbreaks. They're typically linear plantings, like I said, along the edges. And they really, I mean, trees, it's incredible. They can really slow down wind and prevent a ton of soil erosion. And this is what we saw like after the Great Depression. There, you know, we had the Dust Bowl, right? And that was because there were no trees slowing down wind. And so we had this movement. The Conservation Corps was formed to plant windbreaks throughout the U.S., and they really were functional. And since then, it's so sad because so many of those windbreaks have since been taken out, but we've really got to get back to replanting them because just a few rows of trees are hugely beneficial to farms.
Okay, well, one thing that I had a question about here is I know that coming from the National Center for Appropriate Technology, is this kind of concepts that we're talking about, can it be scaled to actually compete or replace the big industrial agricultural system that's developed over the last number of decades? Is this something that's even possible?
I think so, for sure. I mean, the neat thing about agroforestry, all these practices that we're talking about, is that there are so many ecological benefits, you know, like you mentioned, and, you know, they provide habitat to wildlife and they reduce reliance on agrochemicals. They are just so beneficial. They sequester carbon dioxide, but they also have a ton of economic benefits. I briefly mentioned it, but agroforestry systems on average produce 140% more than monocultures do. And so these systems, you can apply them on a large scale and you're actually making more money. So, and you're having, you know, your farm's going to be more resilient. It's going to be more resilient in terms of just it's, you know, the farm ecosystem. And also because, you know, if you have more than one crop, if the market goes down for one crop, you've got another crop to fall back on. So these systems make sense economically and ecologically, which is so cool. So I think they totally can be scaled. Like, honestly, agroforestry is going to save the world, I think.
Well, one of the things that I think is that because of climate adaptation and the need to do that, every farmer should have a climate adaptation plan. Otherwise, they're just asking for trouble. That a lot of the monoculture is going to be driven by needing to adapt to systems like this. But we're also going to have better educated monoculture, mono producer people, because a lot of times they're just the factory workers of the farm. So anyway, that's my opinion. So how do you think food forests mimic the structure and composition of an early forest that's trying to take back the pasture land or the area that's available?
Yeah. So food forests, you know, going back to kind of what that practice is, again, it's about seven layers of foliage. And, you know, like we mentioned, it's typically an overstory of trees, an understory of taller trees, then bushes and shrubs, and then understory crops and vines. And the reason that we like to say they look like early succession forests is because early succession forests, those are typically forests where tree canopies are smaller. The tree canopies don't dominate the entire site. And so the canopy is not closed, which means a lot of light can still enter down into the understory layers. And what this means is that forests at this stage of succession typically have high species diversity. So, you know, it's not just
they
like...
They have what?
High species diversity. So
what's it mean?
It's not just like...
plants.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So right. It's not just like redwoods, you know, redwood space really close together with a really dense canopy where no light can enter to the understory below. It's typically smaller trees and a lot of light can still enter. So there's also room for shrubs and ground cover and, you know, things like that. And so that's what we're trying to mimic when we design food forests. You know, we're really trying to maximize species diversity and, you know, so that you can get a wide diversity of crops. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. So we're going to be at the end. We've got 1 minute. So I was wondering if you could just give us a couple of points about how food forests really do benefit communities.
Oh, yeah. I think there are so many benefits. You know, they can be really great spaces for the community to connect if they are, you know, community forests, food forests. They can be hubs for people to come together, for people to meet their neighbors. They can be used as outdoor classrooms. I know, like Miami-Dade County, they actually have food forests in 28 schools, and these food forests are used as outdoor classrooms for kids. And you know, in if they're in urban areas, food forests can be a refuge for humans to connect with nature, or they can be, you know, habitat for wildlife, biodiversity. That's super important. But you know, I think like the thing about this system in particular is that they're able to produce a high volume and a high variety of food in a really small area. So that is really, really great for urban areas or for your backyard, you know, just okay. For homesteading. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. You've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our guests here today. Thank you, Catherine Favor from the National Center for Appropriate Technology. Thank you very much. And we want to thank our Emmy award-winning producer who has the statue sitting right next to his bedstand, I'm sure, Adam Rich. And we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
My grandma said, play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and Jay, eat your veggies.
Only from a sustainable food source. All right? Till next time. Bye-bye.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about what's happening to the birds, or is this really the canary in the coal mine? And we're joined by Dawn Hewitt, editor of Birdwatchers Digest. And my reference to the canary in the coal mine, clearly, hopefully people know. Right, the coal miners used to bring the canary down in, and if the canary died, it was an indication there was toxic gas. So Dawn, is the canary dying?
Oh man, I try to be an optimist, but in this case, it's really hard to be optimistic. You know, a couple of months ago, there was a report in various scientific journals about how, relative to 1970, there are an estimated 3 billion, with a B, fewer birds living in North America right now. And that was really kind of a cold water in the face to realize that bird populations could be measured and had been being measured all these years, and that we've lost so many birds.
Is this a decline across all species, or is it like specific species have been dying off, or what's the deal?
Well, grassland species have been particularly hard hit. And, you know, actually there are some species and types of birds that have been increasing. Their populations have been increasing, even since the 70s. But it has been more than offset by the number of birds, individual birds that have been on decline. Grassland species, primarily, I would say, because of habitat loss. Those are birds like dick thistles and bobolinks. I'm thinking of, maybe also upland sandpipers, but birds that they need grasslands, native grasslands like prairies, and not vast monocultures of agricultural land, where pesticides kill the foods, the little grubs and insect larvae that they feed their babies, and herbicides that wipe out the quote weeds that they need for their seeds. So that to me seems to be the biggest explanation why we've seen such a decrease in bird numbers since the 1970s. But, you know, there's something else. We often think about when we were kids, you know, there were woods that are now subdivisions and neighborhoods and all that. We can all remember clearly examples of places that used to be natural areas and now they've been paved or otherwise developed. But we're thinking about that from our childhood, which, you know, were maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But even that baseline we were starting from was so vastly different from the habitats and natural areas that were available to wildlife 50 years prior, or 50 years prior, or 50 years prior. We have never seen what the wildlife of North America looked like hundreds of years ago. We've heard stories about passenger pigeons, you know, 3 billion individual birds completely gone, a species wiped out. We can't even imagine how probably darkened the skies and pooped on the landscape. But they're gone now, and there's no trace of them except for a few examples in museums. But we just don't know, can't imagine the abundance of wildlife before the Europeans arrived on this continent. We have a biased perspective, even when we think about how things used to be.
Those darn Europeans, they caused a lot of trouble for everybody, not just the birds and the insects. So,
yeah, no kidding, right?
Yeah.
Maybe peoples, too, yeah.
Yeah, definitely people. So, yeah. So tell us a little bit about where you live now and what you do for a living.
Sure, sure. I live in kind of an urban setting in Marietta, Ohio. This is the world headquarters for Birdwatchers Digest, which is North America's oldest popular magazine about wild birds, written for the people who enjoy them. I'm a birder. I've been a birder since 1979 when I took a college course in lab ornithology, but we could get extra credit for hanging out with the local bird club. So I got up early before 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning, one morning for extra credit, just to go birding in Morgantown, West Virginia, and I loved it. I loved birding. I loved looking for species I hadn't seen before and listening for sounds that I had ignored, and it changed my life. It was a college course that really changed my life. So I've been a serious birder since 1979. I lived in Bloomington, Indiana for 31 years, and I was a birder there, too. That's really where I honed my skills as a birder, and I got to go birding with really wonderful birders. And then at age 55, 6 years ago, I...
Uh-oh, you've told people your age.
Yeah. 6 years ago, pushing 7 years ago, I found my dream job here at Birdwatchers Digest as the managing editor. So now, I am so lucky, blessed. I get paid to think about birds and to encourage people to enjoy and respect and be concerned about bird habitat and conservation.
Well,
and
when we lived in England, I mean, bird watching was a big thing.
It's a religion.
Yeah. Is it a big thing here in the U.S.? I don't hear that much about it.
Well, yeah, this number is not right, but there are something like 3 million birders in the United States. And if you look at all the people who feed the birds and are just aware of and enjoy the birds in their backyard, I mean, it's a big thing. But the really dedicated birders, like me, the people who go out specifically to find birds, to find new species, or just to enjoy migration, who's passing through right now and how that changes. There are hundreds of thousands of birders in North America, but this is a much bigger country than England is. So
don't tell them that, Dawn. So
yeah,
let me say something too, is that probably the bigger figure, which I haven't looked at recently, but I know right around 2008 or 2009, I was looking up about birds and bluebirds and things, and I saw that people spent $3 billion, that's with a B, dollars the year before on stuff to be birders.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
really an industry. It's not just people saying, oh, aren't the birds cute?
Right, exactly. But even people who just say, aren't the birds cute, and I think I'll feed them, they spend a whole lot of money
yeah.
on bird seed and bird houses.
Yeah.
And bird seed's kind of expensive. So, and then there's optics, you know? Serious birders have to have binoculars and often spotting scopes. And I personally have binoculars in my car, next to my kitchen window. I have them in my office window. And then I have my good binoculars that I take when I'm operating.
Your dress-up binoculars.
That's right. No, they're really good binoculars. They're Victory SF binoculars, and they are the best binoculars in the world, and I'm really, really, really lucky to have them.
Well, so, you're the editor. You should have them.
I should have them.
Yes, that's right. So what did you want to be when you were a little girl, and how has that translated into what you're doing now?
Oh, I never had a clear idea of what I wanted to be. I mean, even as a child, I didn't know, and in college, I didn't know, and I didn't have a clear vision of what I wanted for my future. It wasn't until I landed this job at age 55 that I was like, oh, man, this is it? This is, wow, oh, this is it. I didn't know, but as a kid, I loved hanging out in my grandfather's farm fields and going for walks in the woods and just playing outdoors, although I wasn't really a nature geek, as some kids are. So that, too, didn't hit me until I was in college, when I really started caring about wildflowers and habitats and habitat diversity, biodiversity, all that. So, you know, I loved being outdoors, and I loved canoeing. In high school, I'd gone on long canoe trips and hiking and backpacking and all that, but I really didn't connect with nature, I suppose, until I got hooked on birds.
Okay,
bitten
well,
by the birding bug, they say.
You were saying that we've seen about 3 billion fewer, well, we haven't seen them. There are 3 billion
right.
fewer birds, yeah, which is massive, largely due to habitat and environmental issues. So we're seeing the effects of this, but how do we deal with that? I mean, what are some of the alternatives? Because I've always heard, like, okay, you can feed the birds, but then they become dependent, and you know, that's not necessarily a good thing either. What can individuals do to help stem this problem?
I would say feeding the birds is not going to help the birds. It can even be harmful if you provide feeders but then don't clean them. Dirty bird feeders can really be a vector for disease for birds. But there are things we can do to help birds. And some of them include things like supporting small-scale and local farms rather than large industrial farms that are so heavily dependent upon chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides.
But you mean by supporting, you mean like buying food from them, or in what way?
I support my local farmers market. I shop there just about every week and try to buy as much of my food as I can from small-scale farmers. They may not be certified organic, but often they are grown using organic methods, and that means they're bug-friendly, and bug-friendly is bird-friendly.
Woohoo! I love that. Yes, I agree.
and even in our own yards, when we're gardening, if we can not use pesticides and herbicides, you know, there are companion plants that can be effective at deterring insects in our gardens. We need to value insects as pollinators and just as baby bird food, because that's what insect love is. It's baby bird food. And grubs in the yard and earthworms, we need to encourage those things by planting more native plants, which birds recognize. They've evolved to recognize native plants. And native plants are, you know, adapted for native insects. It's this whole native ecosystem that is so valued. There's a recent study that said that I'm going to get these numbers wrong too. But
well, that's
like
that's okay, Don, because we make up most of our statistics here, so just make up whatever number you want.
Give me 5 minutes, and I'll tell you the exact accurate number.
Well, 90% of all statistics are made up anyway. So
okay, that's good. But so I won't use a number here. But native plants are so much more productive at providing native insects that native birds recognize and eat. So if there's one change you want to make to help the birds, it's to rip out your pretty plants and replace them with native plants.
Well, native plants can be very beautiful, especially if you do companion planting and
absolutely
fantastic plants. It's just that we don't have education around those.
Exactly. And we seem to think that exotic is somehow classier or more special, but it seems like we're making the unfamiliar plants common, and the plants that have been here for thousands of years are on the retreat, you know?
Yeah, I think
we used to have thousands and thousands of acres of prairie, and now prairie is just in little tiny pockets here and there. And so what happens to the prairie birds and other species that were dependent on prairies? They're in retreat.
Okay, well, with that in mind, I want to remind everybody that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God. And apparently it's the end of the world for the birds, because so what you're saying, and it sounds like the birds, the disappearing of the birds is a byproduct of an unhealthy and environmentally unhealthy lifestyle that we have adopted. And if we adopt a more environmentally healthy lifestyle, then the birds hopefully will respond in kind. Is that?
Well, wait, I want to say something about that, because right. When we say it's the end of the world as we know it and thank God, the what we really want to talk about is things are happening and we're not happy and sometimes very sad. We're very sad about it. But what can we do to put these something new in its place? That's where we're going with all of this.
Right. Well, the end of the world as we know it is that world that has resulted in the death of 3 billion birds.
Yeah.
So that's coming to an end. So, you were talking about supporting, smaller agricultural activities. Some of the things I know that kill birds a lot are vehicles, tall buildings, even cell towers, things like that. Are there things we could be doing that would minimize some of that damage?
Two things come to mind right away. And one of them is that in New York, the state of New York, for all municipal or state-funded buildings, they need to have glass, bird-friendly glass installed. This is a trend that is increasing. There are ways that glass can be built that birds realize that it is an impervious surface. You know, transparent windows are completely foreign to birds. They just don't get the whole concept of, what do you mean I can see through it, but I can't fly through it? And that's why that's why glass and tall skyscrapers are so deadly to birds. And especially when the lights are on at night. If skyscrapers would turn out their lights at night, birds wouldn't be attracted to them. But as it is, they see lights at night and try to fly right through their windows. It can be a gruesome sight. There are organizations called Lights Out Chicago, Lights Out Indianapolis, Lights Out Columbus. And what these groups do is, first thing in the morning during migration, they walk the streets and pick up carcasses, sometimes dozens or hundreds a day of dead birds that have flown into buildings.
That's so sad.
Yeah, so just turn out the lights on tall buildings at night, or even your home, especially spring and fall during migration. Bird-friendly buildings or bird-safe buildings is one thing. But another thing is just keeping cats indoors. I have 6 cats, including 4 kittens I got recently. And they're all indoors. I plan to build a catio for them next spring so that they can crawl out a window and have a safe space. They won't get hit by cars, and I don't need to worry about mean people doing bad things to my cat. But even as it is, right now my cats are quite happy and safe and healthy inside. They don't get fleas. They don't get ear mites. But cats are estimated to kill millions of birds, wild birds, and other things, so mice and other native wildlife every year. So domestic cats are not native to North America. It is an exotic, invasive species. And here where I live in Marietta, there are stray cats all over the place. And I've seen countless cats with birds in their mouths. But it's not just stray or feral cats that are causing a problem to birds. It's domestic cats that are well-loved and well-fed. Cats just, by nature, by their instincts, are hunters.
Yep.
And they will catch and kill wildlife.
Yep. They can't help themselves.
They can't help themselves.
No.
They're not being bad. They're just being cats.
Well, let me ask you a question. I wondered if you've heard of something called silvopasture.
I have not.
So this is a concept when you're talking about things that we could do. So people who do have wide open spaces or even an acre of land or a couple of acres could create a more natural environment that actually changes everything for the birds. and also for insects, beneficial insects. So silvopasture is, I can't quote the exact definition, but it is about taking forest land and creating like meadows that could be grazed by animals, interspersed in the forest. And they've been doing this in Britain for a while. There are several large projects there, and it has brought in species of birds that they haven't seen in 100 years have come back to the land. It's so invigorating to read about what's happening there. And new plants.
That sounds very cool.
Old plants have appeared that were not there before, but were there 100 years ago.
That's wonderful.
Yes, and I was thinking that could be really something that could be downsized for lesser lands, you know, people who don't have 100 acres or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I even think of my own backyard, which is just an urban, probably quarter acre, if even that, but it's a long, deep yard. And I think of it as being potentially habitat. It still has grass in it. You know, a monocultural grass has very little value to birds in general, especially if it's sprayed with herbicides or pesticides. But I should be planting oak trees and maple trees and, you know, serviceberry and other native plant species. Once upon a time, the place where I lived was a forest. Actually, it was right across the street from ancient Indian burial mounds. But there's no reason why we can't convert all of our lawns into wildlife habitat again. If we just change our aesthetic for what is a beautiful yard from a vast carpet of green grass, if we are willing to share the land we call our own with species that were there way before my ancestors got there, then I think we would have a very different aesthetic for how to make our lawns, our yards, more accommodating to wildlife, including insects.
Okay, well, so far we've come up with shop at your local farmer's market, get rid of your lawn, get rid of all of your cats. That's one I prefer.
Don't get rid of them.
No. I'm interpreting this as I choose to interpret it. So I'm going to use this as part of my lobbying campaign to get rid of some of the cats.
It won't work, Don. Don't worry.
But I was going to ask you, one of the things that I have heard, because I do a lot of studying of the technologies, and wind turbines, of course, always get the silly blame of killing off all of the birds. But I was actually reading something about the flashing lights on these towers, on cell towers, on wind turbines that are there to protect small aircraft, actually attract birds, and the birds often circle them. And then fall to the ground primarily due to exhaustion or whatever, and then are killed by predators as opposed to hitting these towers. So is that something that you're saying that's a true thing?
It is absolutely a true thing. I've Googled it. I've looked at governmental reports on some of these things. Yeah, and sometimes there are like 1,000 dead birds of one species beneath a cell phone tower.
Wow.
And often the lights are to blame. I mean, you know, I talked about birds just don't understand the concept of glass. They also don't understand the concept of artificial lights at night. Birds evolved with dark skies and dark landscapes at night. And they navigated by the stars. Who knows what all these satellites in the sky are doing regarding bird migration. I don't know that. But yeah, it's lights on towers that can cause a serious problem, a disorientation among migrating birds. And, you know, even on 9/11, where at the memorial in New York City, there are bird watchers looking at the night light display, and when they count 1,000 birds circling the buildings confused, they have the power to turn off the light for 20 minutes and let the birds fly on. This happens every year. It's a thing. And then after 20 minutes, the lights come on, and then eventually the birds start circling and getting disoriented again, because September 11th is really a time of high bird migration. So yeah, lights on towers are a serious problem.
Yeah, I'd heard some of the studies were showing going with solid lights, which was less disorient, going with blue lights rather than red lights. So it seems like it's a problem we can solve if we just decide to solve it.
Well, possibly. But I have to disagree with you, Jay, because wind turbines really have been known to chop up birds. They have.
Oh, now you're on now you're on dangerous. I was with you up with the cats. Now I'm a little bit concerned with the wind turbines.
Well, but placement is a critical factor. So I am a proponent of wind. I love wind. I would love to have a little vertical turbine on my roof. But placement of wind turbines along known migration paths is just a death sentence for birds. That it really is. But there are bird-safe wind technologies. I'm all in favor of safe, bird-safe wind power. That's all I can say. There was a proposal to...
Thank you, Dawn. That was very good. That was very good.
Yeah. No, I think we've got to share the space. I mean, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. There are places where birds don't migrate. Let's locate the towers there.
That's right. That's right. You convinced him, Dawn.
I hope so.
Thank you.
If it's a bargaining thing, let's bargain some cats away for and then we'll put the wind turbines where you want them.
I love cats.
Yes. So how can we use the power that we have as people who care about birds or birders and all that money that they use, that they spend? How can we get them to do a better job at being more sustainable in their practices?
One thing, this is such a little thing, but every year I buy a duck stamp. Duck stamps are a federal program intended really, I think, for hunters. I think you're required to have a duck stamp to hunt on a national wildlife refuge. But I buy one. It's $25 every year, and it gets me into national wildlife refuges free, although many national wildlife refuges are free anyhow. But all that money goes to buying wildland habitat. So it adds lands to national wildlife refuges. And I spend $25 and I'm contributing to an increase in wildlife habitat in North America. So buying a duck stamp is a small, easy thing. I also support organizations like Land Trust, Sycamore Land Trust in Indiana, and the Friends of Lower Muskingum River here where I live, and the Nature Conservancy, which buys land or maintains conservation easements and ensures that this will be preserved as wildlife habitat in perpetuity. Well, I don't know how. I mean, there are plenty of birders who are just recreational birders and are not seeing a bigger picture of the impacts of their hobby on the environment. For instance, I fly a lot to see birds. I'm headed to Oregon later this week for birding. I think it's going to be really good. But when I get back, I will pay a carbon fee, a self-imposed carbon fee. There are some websites that come with high recommendations and with scores for efficient use of money, so that the carbon I have contributed in my flights is mitigated by planting trees or building wind turbines or solar panels somewhere.
Well, Dawn, how can people contact Birdwatchers Digest?
Well, the easiest way is just to go to our website, birdwatchersdigest.com.
And can they join or contribute or do something?
Yeah, it's not really join. We are a private for-profit company. We're not like the Nature Conservancy or Audubon or Cornell Lab of Ornithology. So it's not anything you join. It's something you subscribe to. Although we're so personable and we're a small local business, you know?
That's great.
There's just 13 people on our staff.
Okay.
But if you go to our website, you'll get answers to all sorts of questions about birds. You'll get tons of content. We have thousands of web pages all about wild birds.
Okay, well, Dawn, we're going to have to cut it off here, but we want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke and Dawn Hewitt, editor of Birdwatchers Digest. We also want to thank our Emmy Award-winning producer, Adam Rich, Thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother told you while watching birds, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and turn your lights off at night.
Okay. Okay. Till next time. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you. Mother Earth will sing and her children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, KBOO.FM. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.